California cops, can I kill one in on a on average one HUN 100 people, but in California cops kill on average 100 people, but for DEC for decades all no CO no cop has VGO gone to T trial for killing you and until now in the case of Oscar Grant. Who do we have here tonight? Could everybody introduce themselves?
Yes.
So people know.
My name is Rekia Mohammed Jibrin. I've been doing some legal research for this for this case in particular, and I've been doing independent legal research for the community.
I'm Brother Keith Mohammed from the Nation of Islam, and we have done what we can to help be a voice for the voiceless poor.
Yes, my name is Gerald, and I work with the New Year's Movement for Justice.
I'm a Dr. Ramona Tasco. I'm a medical doctor and an ordained minister representing the community in this matter, recognizing that this situation with Oscar Grant has happened one time too many, and we're determined that this be the last time that it occur on our watch.
My name is Brother Charles. I'm from the Nation of Islam. I'm here assisting me here with Brother Keith. Okay.
Can we give the viewers the the history
of
this case, of this situation?
Well, incident. I think that I and all of us that are sitting here were witnesses through the television news of the horrific shooting, murder of Oscar Grant on January the 1st. The video footage did not find its release as fast as I think word of mouth of what had happened. In Oakland, we had a men-only town hall meeting on the Saturday following January the 1st, and as God is my witness, on that day, we did not have a full knowledge of what happened with Oscar. We knew that he had been killed. We had over 100 men gathered together at Olivet Institutional Missionary Baptist Church, and I brought the issue up, and most of the men did not have an awareness yet of what happened. On the following Monday, we had a town hall meeting in East Oakland, sponsored with Councilperson Desley Brooks, and she and I began to talk before the town hall began of what she had heard about that case. And she'd heard a few things, I'd heard a few things, and the very next morning I spoke with Brother Minister Christopher Muhammad. He had just found out on that Tuesday morning and was livid. And those that know my brother, he is very spirited. And he asked me right away, what are you and the black elected officials and clergy in Oakland doing about this case? You need, he said, to call them together and have an emergency meeting. I agreed with him. We made a call, and we held a meeting at Olivet Institutional Missionary Baptist Church. That meeting led to a call to District Attorney Tom Orloff, made by Councilperson Desley Brooks, to inquire what actions he was taking in reference to the murder of Oscar Grant by Johannes Mezeli. At that point, the district attorney was hesitant. He didn't want to talk with her much. He certainly didn't want to talk with us. After she encouraged him and pressed him, he said, fine, I'll speak to three of you. Well, there were about 20 of us in the room, and we took consensus that no, he will meet us all, or he'll meet none of us at all. And in that moment, we decided that on the very next day, we would hold a press conference on the steps of the Alameda County Courthouse, which we did, which was in the morning, the same day that Oscar's funeral was taking place. Some of us left after the press conference to attend the funeral. Others of us went right away to the office of District Attorney Tom Orloff to quiz him and to push him, to inform the public what actions he would take in the murder of Oscar Grant, because at that point, Johannes Mezeli had not been arrested. There had been no statement from law enforcement that he had any intention to do anything at all in reference to the case. So the community was angry, of course, among the activists, among the youth, among the Democrats, among the Republicans, among the liberals, among the conservatives. Anybody that had witnessed the murder of Oscar Grant was justifiably, righteously angry. And so we held that press conference. We went to see the district attorney, and we did question him. He told us on that day that he was considering charges, but he would need time. And he said that law enforcement officers are given greater time or greater flexibility, I'll use that language, to build up their defense as a result of the unique relationship between law enforcement and the district attorney's office. We demanded of him at that moment that you, Mr. Orloff, need to hold a press conference and tell the public what your intentions are to bring charges, that you claim it would take you a certain amount of time to develop your case because he said he didn't want to have a weak case, he wanted a winning case, and he wanted to take his time. He said to us, no, I'm not going to have a press conference. You do it. Mm-hmm. Well, by God's grace, surrounding those activities were black elected officials and their staffs. The very next day, Mayor Ron Dellums apparently made contact with the district attorney. This is after there had been some riotous, we'll call it that, behavior in Oakland, some angry protest is really a better language. And after the angry protesters, the mayor went out to calm them for a time, but the very next day, his office held a press conference to declare that he would encourage OPD, or instruct them, I should say, to enter the investigative phase as they would any other homicide in the city of Oakland, even though it was under BART jurisdiction. And he encouraged the district attorney to do the exact thing that the community demanded that he do, and that was to declare what his intentions were in the murder of Oscar Grant. And from that moment forward, it seemed that the wheels of justice began to roll a little faster. So within 5 or 6 days of that press conference, in fact, I think it was 3 or 4 days, that D.A. Orloff did bring charges against Johannes Mezeli, who quite frankly was a flight risk and evaded the state and found himself in Tahoe, where he was vacationing or fishing while we were mourning and grieving the loss of Oscar Grant III. And so we're thankful that he was arrested, but from that point to this, his defense attorneys, who are some of the best attorneys in the country. So when you say Attorney Raines, we're talking about the man that I believe Barry Bonds hired to protect his interest. Mm-hmm. So Attorney Raines is a high-powered attorney that's been paid for by the mm-hmm. police union, which is why Bart did not fire Johannes Meserle. They gave him time mm-hmm. that the union could gather up whatever resource required to get him the best attorney possible for the type of case that he was fighting. And for them, that appears to have been, in their view, Attorney Raines. And so Bart never fired Meserle. In fact, to this date, Bart has yet to discipline any single individual for the actions in the murder of Oscar Grant. And that has prompted what we have here tonight. And that is a group of community citizens who are responsibly sharing our views on what justice looks like in the murder of Oscar Grant.
And in G, F, and in fact, the R, E, S, T, the rest of the C, O, cops who were there, when Oscar was murdered, R, N, O, now, B, back at work. The rest of the BART cops that were there when Oscar Grant was murdered are now back at work.
That is the most recent report.
That's from last night, or actually early this morning we heard that. And we heard that there was going to actually be a gathering of people tonight to protest that.
And who would be the sponsors or the organizers of this?
Do you remember who that was? Do you remember who that was, Frank? They? And? Never? They never? Give that information. I was on Channel 2 News at 5 this morning.
Let me say that in their efforts to secure a change of venue motion, the defense attorneys are fabricating manufacturing news for the media so that it gives the appearance that there is more media attention on the case than is warranted. Any issue such as this warrants media attention. In fact, the media has been slow in reporting very critical elements of the case, which says to us that the media is a necessary vehicle of information for the community, but it's not necessarily the friend of the community. I watched a judge chide Attorney Raines for giving so many of his opinions to the press in the face of a gag order. Well, from that moment to this, rather than speak to the press in violation of the gag order, his motions have been made public. So what we're reading now are born out of his motions that did not have to be in the hands of the media without thorough investigation. It just is no coincidence to me that he filed his motion on September the 11th, and he's selecting special dates and times to release information. Otherwise, the media could have found out on October the 2nd during the hearing what was in his motion. But his motion found its way to the San Francisco Chronicle in publication first, then to the Oakland Tribune. And for all of the months that we have gathered to share information, I don't know what gathering they're talking about on tonight of protest, because we are well acquainted with most of the protesters.
You guys would know if anybody knew.
Now, there are people that were scheduled to gather before the change of motion was announced just to discuss the matter, because we gather all the time to discuss the issue.
I was surprised that you would not be there. When we heard that this morning, we thought, well, why are you guys doing this when that's going on, as if...
Well, in fact, there was an event that was to take place this evening at 6:30 that was not a protest to the fact that BART officers have been released back to work, most of them, nor was it a protest to the fact that Michael Raines is seeking this change of venue. It was the second phase tribunal, community tribunal, that was to examine the evaluation of the transcripts of the preliminary hearing. And that was to take place at 6:30 this evening at the Miracles of Faith Church. But the executive director of BAM, by any means necessary, arrived late from Detroit and was not able to arrive in time for us to have that town hall meeting. So I'm pretty certain that that was the event that might have been alluded to, and that event has been postponed until a time when we can actually do it in a more well-informed fashion.
Okay.
And let me add that Attorney Raines is putting more weight on our actions and words than they deserve. Now, we are flattered that he would give us so much attention. However, if he's trying to poll the public over whether or not the general public can fairly try the murderer, Johannes Mezeli, then quite frankly, we're not on the jury. And I don't think that we would pass the test if any of us, all of us, I think, are Alameda County residents, but I think that we would be forthright in the jury procedure. And if they asked me if I knew anything about this case, and I would tell them I know quite a bit about this case and you don't want me on the jury, so why don't you excuse me now, give me my parking money, and let me go, because I think you know my involvement. But my involvement is not the equal of the average Alameda County citizen. I'm blessed to have been given a t-shirt by my friend here that says, I am Oscar Grant, and I wear it with pride. But every time I wear it, I meet somebody who asks me, who is Oscar Grant? Because they see that's not my picture on the shirt. They see it's someone else's face, and they want to know, why am I wearing such a t-shirt? And the reality is that the community, while there certainly are persons who are aware, it is unfair, and it is in fact a bold-faced lie for an attorney to suggest that a Caucasian police officer cannot find justice in the city or the county of Alameda, when the greatest police abuse case in the county that involved more people was the Riders incident.
There you go.
And the Riders, who brutalized and falsely arrested over 100 people, mostly in West Oakland, were tried and exonerated in trial, most of them. One of them is still running for his freedom. But they went to trial and were found not guilty, or acquitted, I should say, in the city of Oakland. So the idea that you can't have a fair jury in Oakland, first, to me, is a slap in the face of the many decent human beings, when the county of Alameda is only 13% black. So to take a poll and say that of the 13% black people in this county, that you cannot find a fair jury. So I guess the 13% are so powerful around here that everything goes our way. But if you look at law, that's certainly not the case.
And Frank is asking, who is Oscar Grant?
Well, of course, Oscar is our brother, who was murdered by Johannes Mezeli while on a BART track, BART train, while BART officers were allegedly seeking participants in a disruption on the train. When the officers arrived to the train, rather than investigate with justice, they immediately made the presumption, particularly Officer Tony Peroni, or Anthony Peroni, that Oscar and his friends, really as a result of racial profiling, were the persons that they were looking for. They had no physical description of note other than to know that there had been a disruption on a train and that black people were involved. Well, quite frankly, Oscar is black, but his friends are multiracial. And they were not all male. He was looking for males. I think Oscar's girlfriend was there on that night. But when Officer Peroni arrived on the scene, he immediately pointed his taser weapon, turned it on, aimed it at these innocent people, and began using threatening language and offensive language when speaking with them.
That's correct.
He told them, get off the F-word train, in fact, my train, like he was the owner. And he snatched people off the train. He threw them into the barriers and walls inside the BART station. When Johannes Mezeli arrived, Oscar was on or placed on his knees. They threw him to his face, and after hurling racial epithets at him, they jumped up, Mezeli did, and pulled his weapon, carefully aimed according to Judge Don Clay, and fired this weapon in his back. But by God's grace, unlike most of what they call justifiable homicides, there wasn't one witness, there wasn't two witnesses, there were dozens of witnesses and dozens of cell phone cameras as well as the BART platform camera. So the question is not whether or not they can find a fair jury. The question is whether or not the jury will be allowed to perform its duty in the face of overwhelming evidence. It's not that the jury is unfair, but the evidence is overwhelming. And rather than confront the evidence with truth and argument, the defense attorney is seeking to cloud the people's view of what happened, remove it to a county that would be officer-friendly.
You know, you asked the question, who was Oscar Grant? And Oscar Grant was a young man who I think any African-American family would be proud to say was their son.
That's right.
He was a sweet young man who was a father, he was a son, he was a nephew, he was a brother, he was a surrogate father figure.
He was a father too, he had a daughter.
He was a surrogate father figure within his home, he was a surrogate provider, as best he knew to be, to his mom, who was a single parent. And when I say a surrogate, he tried to step to the plate like
a man.
Like a man. He worked. He brought home his earnings. He shared them with his mother's household. He was an obedient son. He was a loving son. He was a caring son. He was likewise a caring nephew. He was, I'm told, best friends to his uncle, his mother's brother, his uncle Cephas. He grew up in the church. He even spent quite a bit of time in some of the organized programs at Allen Temple Baptist Church. He was nurtured. He didn't grow up as a weed. He was not wild and reckless. He was a young man who came up under the struggle of not having a father in the household, who had only a mother in the primary household to guide him and to lead him, and that notwithstanding, he still flourished as a gentle spirit. He was giving, he was generous, he made lots of friends. Everyone loved him, as was made even evident at the time of his homegoing services. His daughter loved him. His daughter couldn't sleep without him. We're told that she would rest on his chest and fall asleep on top of him at night, much as a child might rest on a mother's bosom. This child loved her daddy. And we take a lot of instruction from that when we see a human being who's able to emanate that sort of tenderness to a child. Oscar Grant was a good guy.
That's right.
He was not someone who was a troublemaker in the community. He was not someone who fit the racial stereotype when the racial stereotype is correct. Most times the racial stereotype is incorrect. But in this particular case, Oscar Grant was a young man who had just left his mom's home that night, celebrating her birthday. And in honor of her birthday, he honored her birthday wish, son, don't drive into the city. Mm-hmm. Son, do me a favor, take BART. It'll be safer. That way I don't have to worry about you. His mother tells the story that it was on that night, the night of her birthday, New Year's Eve, that she saw the greatest love from her son and lost him within hours as he tried to honor her. Mm. Imagine, just imagine what that mother must feel and what she will feel for all of her life.
R, the M, E, D, I, the media, P, A, paints him as a R, no, as a E, X, C, oh, an ex-con.
Yes, they do. And Oscar Grant, unfortunately, suffered the same challenge that most African-American males suffer in America. Mm. When African-American males attain the age of about 11, 12 years old, there's a guarantee that law enforcement agencies and agencies that are characterized by institutional racism, including educational centers, public schools, junior high schools, mm-hmm. high schools, are more likely to stereotype them as problematic to society and create scenarios to prove their point. And so rather than try to prove that they are good kids, they are determined to prove that they are bad kids. And so they're always looking for trouble. And if you look for trouble, you can create trouble. And this, unfortunately, is part of what is exposed in this horrific case that we face today, the Oscar Grant case. When we say we are Oscar Grant, particularly when young brothers say we are Oscar Grant, what they are saying is that what happened to Oscar could have happened to us, in some instances did happen to us, and will continue to happen to us if we don't stop and make a change today. And so the stereotypic profile of an Oscar Grant at age 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 led to circumstances in which, had he been a different color, he would have been given the benefit of the doubt on circumstances that resulted in a brief incarceration that had no complications, a model inmate. And a model inmate who fit the stereotype for institutional racist, who was placed on the unforgiving track that so many African-American males get placed on. One strike against you, don't wait for strike two and three, because it's guaranteed you will spiral down. Oscar had his brief run with law enforcement, and he weathered that with great dignity and successfully. And he was not tarnished by it in any permanent way, which in and of itself is a testimony to the kind of nurturing that he received and the kind of support that he received from his family and from his community. This is a young man who wasn't about to turn his life around. His life was already turned in the right direction.
That's right.
This was a young man who was going to go forward and be more careful in his strategies in navigating institutional racism in America. He was on his way towards success.
And by the way, there's no crime about being being a ex-con. The crime would be to be an escaped con. So the fact that he did some time, well, that meant that he paid his debt to society. So whether or not he had done some time had nothing to do with the actions of Anthony Peroni, who aggressed and instigated the evening that led to the murder of Oscar Grant, and it had nothing to do with Johannes Mezeli, for at that moment, they didn't even know his name. All they knew is Peroni was looking for black males. And all they knew is that Oscar was a black male. They didn't know anything else about him except that when they aggressed him with their words and in some ways with their actions, he spoke back to them about their aggression. To the point that he even said to them, according to reports, "Don't tase me. I'm a father."
That's right.
How does that prompt a police officer to throw him on his face, hurl racial epithets at him, and then get back so I can shoot him, which is what their actions were? And so, you know, we want to be clear that nothing that Oscar Grant did warranted the use of any weapon by any enforcement officer on that night.
And let me just add that, for the record, for those who would be part of the viewing or listening audience who want to weigh this story objectively and yet have a question regarding his past run with the law, there was nothing that Oscar Grant did in his past that brought harm, hurt, anguish to any other human being. No one suffered other than his mother and his family. The predictable disappointment that any parent might have when a child makes a bad decision. They forgave him. The system forgave him because he paid his debt, but at no time had he harmed anyone else. We're not talking about assault. We're not talking about rape. We're not talking about acts of violence against other human beings.
Excuse me?
In on that N-O-N-I, on that night, he was A B A R T a Bart R I a Bart rider who H A happened to be black.
Excuse me, I wanted to add a little bit on the history to try to give a little more political texture into what was actually occurring and led to the actions that we had after Grant was killed, Oscar Grant III was killed. Because context is everything. See, the truth is never abstract. The truth is always concrete. Remember, Obama had just had his victory. This event occurs. They shoot this man in the back. Now, what happened? Did the media immediately share this information with us? That's not what happened. What happened was, and this is a very important component, from the second this thing happened, they were attempting to cover it up. When they killed this man, they were attempting to cover up what had happened.
That's right.
So they took people's cell phones. And you listen to me, Ken. That's your cell phone. You are not obliged to give anyone your cell phone. If you choose to share a file in your cell phone, that's your business. But you are not required to give your personal property to anybody in the name of some jive evidence. All right. But people surrendered their cell phones. Fortunately, not everyone is so obedient. So there are people that kept their cell phone. That's how immediately, it was not the media that shared the information. Someone posted it on the internet, and like wildfire, people that are in the internet started feeling, and it was a buzz. People said, "Did you see that? Go to the internet, check this out. It's on YouTube, it's here, it's there." Now, so it's not just a matter only of word of mouth, but you have a visual also that substantiates this. There's no question that this act occurred. You're starting people talking about it at work and stuff like that. This is blatant. It's very clear.
R O from M I M U L multi V O I view from multiple views.
Oh yeah. Yeah, more than one person and share their video. That's correct. But see, so what you have to see the impact. I've worked on many police brutality cases, but I can tell you, I can't remember very many where we actually had a video of the murder. See, that is a little unusual. So one, it's on the internet. So now, remember, Obama, a black man, has just been elected president. There's a little disorientation within the ruling clique or oligarchy, whatever you choose to call them, as to how to respond to this. You have a black president. We just clearly murdered a black man for no reason. And there is a reason. I mean, let's be clear that the police are trained and inculcated with a sense of racist genocide. It is a genocidal impulse. That's how the finger doesn't just move by itself. It's something that makes a person want to kill another person. And that is, there is a racist, you know, an impulse of racial genocide against black, no doubt about that. This is not the first time that, for instance, a law enforcement officer has, out of nowhere, just shot a citizen. Unfortunately, it happens too often. But here, it was on the internet. So now it's on the internet, and the media has to make a decision. Are they going to get totally left out, or do they, sensationalism is all they're about. If it bleeds, it leads. So they jumped on it, and they put it on the air. Now, once they put it on the air, it was widespread. People who didn't even have computers can now see this. I'm not much for seeing it anymore. I mean, it's painful after a while to see this act over and over again. I can understand. It's not fun, you know, to see this over and over again. But what's important to realize is the general revulsion that existed in the society as a whole. Minister Keith is correct when he says Democrats, Republicans, for the most part, people thought it was just outrageous. Now, that's where that technology was key here. And this is something we have to keep in our minds. The ruling clique cannot control information anymore. And they're worried about this. They're not quite sure. Because usually they rely on what? The head-fixing industry to feed people the storyline, etc., etc. And most cases, people go along with it. No more. Okay? Now, the internet has proven to be a place where you can get reliable information without the permission of the head-fixing industry. And we know they're having a crisis of their own.
J. H. E. Hence this show.
This show. Okay. That's right. Lover.com is an internet radio station. Now, so you have this outrage in our communities. Leaders are organizing. People are conferring. And on the bottom of all of this, a demonstration is called for. I believe it was a Tuesday, the 7th. Now, myself, you know, I go to work every day. I go.
That was Wednesday.
Oh, that was Wednesday. Thank you, Keith. I drove by the thing and I said, all right, let me see what's up. So I'm standing there in the demonstration. And here is what actually occurred. And I think people should be aware. Young people like to march. So the people gave speeches about the situation and described it for. It might have been 3 hours, because it might have started about 4, and at around 7, it looks like people started to want to, you know, to march. And there was some polarization and difference of opinion over whether or not people should march. And I remember some of the organizers did not want people to march and stated such. This is not an opinion, this is just a fact. It looked like to me, about 100 people took off walking to downtown. And I do remember this, because I'm getting old. Now my mind is still fresh, but I wasn't for walking all the way down to 14th Street from Fruitvale. I said, okay, give me hell, y'all. But I'm watching. And what I saw was as they were taking off, the police started to surround them as people started marching. And people continued to march. And what's happening is by the time they get to about where there used to be a BART office across around Lake Merritt BART, around there, the police are trying now desperately to keep these people out of downtown. So they're starting to physically push people and use gas, pepper spray, tear gas on people to prevent them from going downtown. The actual effect this has is to anger people. People are getting angry now because they're being gassed and they are under the illusion that they're free people marching to downtown protesting an injustice.
First Amendment rights.
Exactly. Now, this anger is building up. Every time you get pushed or hit or gassed, you are getting more angry. And the rest is pretty much history. After a while, it's no doubt the crowd broke up and regrouped several times on its way downtown. And there were indeed vehicles damaged, at least one burned, and there were windows broken. I saw in the paper the next day, I did not march all the way downtown with the young people, that 400 windows had been broken. And so me and my partner, we said, hey, there ain't 400 businesses downtown open, but let's go see. So we went down and started counting broken windows the next day. And we counted upward of 35, 36 windows, maybe 40. So the media got the information from the police. Was a lie. They lied. That was not true. I'm not for 30 windows being broken, but I'm saying the information that was put in the newspaper was false information. I can attest to that. Another point I want. So this riot, I don't know how much of a riot it was, as much as it was an attempt of the police to break up a demonstration. That's what I think it was. And by using violence against the demonstrators, people resisted as best they could. And of course, there were people that had different ideas in their heads what they were doing. So you get people burning up garbage cans. Well, that's real dangerous. I mean, come on. What's going on here? See? So there's one more thing I don't want to lose because it went through my mind immediately. Rakia spoke to me earlier about this change of the new business. And I thought that what Minister Keith said about the riders, I mean, I actually think they threw the case. I think the prosecutors actually threw the case because I had interviewed people who were assaulted by those riders who were just ordinary working people who lived in the area. And they were never called as witnesses. Mm. Now, with my little meager resources, if I could track down people like that, it doesn't seem to me they were looking to do a very good job. But you make the point well, because they sure did walk, right? That's a very important point he just made. But, Reiki, would you share with us what you had said to me earlier about this, the whole method, this chicanery? We're talking about a shameless cynic. That's who he is, this Reigns character. He used to, I like to use my own language, but, you know, all right, I'm gonna be gentle here. He was a police officer himself before he became a lawyer, okay? And the reason I have no respect for him at all, and I think he defames the whole, if you can defame the profession of lawyers anymore, he actually wrote a document that said that Oscar Grant caused his own death, that his actions caused his own death. Except there's one problem here. We have video footage, see, of everything that happened. So in that context, for him to make that kind of a comment, we have to have a real sense of what kind of scum, and that, I'm sorry, to accuse a man murdered in such a brutal way of bringing on his own death. I'm sorry. That's my vocabulary. I see scum. Mm-hmm. And that's what he said. It was in the paper. This is not my opinion.
S, especially when he was F A face down.
Yeah, on the ground. But actually, Oscar was trying to prevent violence. All of the information that we have, unfortunately, we're going to have to wait. The family would like to talk about it, you know, later, and they will. You know, the fact of the matter is the young man was trying to prevent violence. That's what he was really trying to do.
You are surrounded by cops. He was face down on the ground, surrounded by cops.
Right. But I mean, before that, he was actually trying to communicate and trying to kind of bring the tension down, you know, before he was on the ground. But Reiki, would you please explain this business, though, about how supposedly Rainey got some little jive professor, whatever that means, to do a poll. Would you explain the value or lack thereof of this poll?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there needs to be some vigilance in the sort of proof that the defense lawyer, Michael Raines, is bringing to the court. And I took a look at the Oakland Tribune articles that came out yesterday. There was a poll of 400 people. There was a survey of 400 people taken, and what was stated in the article is that 46% of the people believe that Johannes Melzerly is guilty enough that And there were more numbers that came out saying that 80% of African Americans in that poll believed that Johannes Melzerly is guilty, and that 33% of whites in that poll believed that Johannes Melzerly is guilty. Now, I think we really have to pay attention to how polls are taken, and I think that we have to pay attention to how evidence is. Conclusions are made from polls like this, and especially given that in Alameda County, you know, there are about 1.5 million people, and 13%, you know, as you had pointed out, Minister Keith, of that population, 13.5% are actually African Americans, and about 56% are whites. Now, if you think about it, 400 people is a pretty small sample size, right? And we also have to just think critically about how information and evidence is being presented and how and what sort of conclusions come out of that. And I kept asking, you know, when you look at Alameda public health statistics, for example, what's the sample size of a study that's done? And you're looking at about 100,000 people, right? So just doing a little bit of math, and I'm not the most math, you know what I mean? When you do some math, you see, well, is you have to ask, one, is this a random sampling, right, of folks? Is this random sampling also representative of the population? What's the probability of African Americans who are selected who are going to say that Johannes Melzerly is guilty? What's the probability of we're going to capture that accurate representation in this population of Alameda County in a sample size of 400? Is that sample size actually large enough? And can probability actually like play out in that as it should, right? So I'm not sure that we are aware, being made aware by that proof that we're getting an accurate picture, right? Of, I mean, 80% is a pretty high number of African Americans believing that Johannes Melzerly is guilty. Now it could be that 80% in that sample believe that, but we don't know whether there were four or five African Americans, right? I mean, quite frankly, if you try and think about the population of Alameda County, you say 13% African Americans, and if you sort of proportionally try and break that down in 400, and I'm sorry to speak statistics, but we're talking basic statistics here. I mean, we're looking at, well, if we took 56% of Alameda County being white, then 228 people of that 400 sample size should be white. If we were to take 13% of Alameda County being black, then 52 people in that study should be black. And it's just that I'm not sure and I'm not convinced necessarily, and I respect professors out there, and I hope this professor at Chico State did what he needs to do in basic statistics, but I'm not convinced that 400 people in a study that has to do with a case this important is enough and is representative. And I also think we need to point out that people don't just go out on the street and take studies. I mean, it's also African Americans and whites who want to participate in a study, mm-hmm. right? So I'm not sure who Michael Raines is, who this mm-hmm. professor is trying to capture. I'm also just not sure, and I'm not convinced that the proof that's being presented to us is quite frankly honest.
And why? How? How does it CO compare to PO polls of other PA ST past TR trials? How does it compare to polls of other past trials that were HE held in Oakland, say?
Well, I would just offer that the perhaps most famous brutality case was also videotaped, and that being of Rodney King in Los Angeles. And unfortunately, the case was moved outside of Los Angeles County, where you have a population that looks something like Oakland's population, and moved to Simi Valley, where you have a population that perhaps looks more like Napa County. And when that trial was moved, it really was not an issue of it being unfair to the defendant. That trial was moved and it became unfair to the people of the state of California. And I would offer that if you remove this trial from this county, that is unfair to the cause of justice, where every registered voter has a right to participate and a duty in civic participation to serve on juries to make sure that justice is served where we live. It would be a slap in our faces because we watched what happened in the Rodney King case. So what they called riotous behavior after that case was because the trial was moved away from the people, and the people knew that the fix was in, and that jury in Simi Valley, and I'm from Southern California originally, that's one of those areas where law enforcement officers would choose to live. As in this area, law enforcement officers may choose to live in the outskirts of Alameda County from Pleasanton or maybe Contra Costa, Antioch sort of areas, or over into Napa, because most of Oakland's police officers do not live in the city of Oakland. They're commuters. And some would say they come like an occupying army or force of outsiders who feel that their jobs are to contain the natives. Well, I wonder whether or not that might have been the mindset of BART police officers on that evening. We don't know, except for really the damaging testimony that they gave themselves. So that when one of the officers, Marisol Dominici, testified in the preliminary hearing, knowing that she would be policing the BART's areas in Oakland on that evening, she testified that when she approached the scene, that she felt that she was going to have to kill somebody. It was so shocking. The judge had to ask her, Judge Clay. I mean, it took him by such a surprise that he didn't wait for the district attorney to ask the question. He asked the question himself, just who were you going to shoot? She testified that she ran through an angry crowd before even reaching Oscar and his friends. But the videotape showed the truth. She didn't run past one person. She must have been scared of her own black shadow. So if blackness frightened her that much, the only black thing that she passed on her way to Oscar and his friends was her shadow. And when she arrived, she's amped up, fearing that they would have to use the ultimate force to contain an issue. And quite frankly, when she and Anthony Peroni arrived, there was no fight going on. So they didn't have to engage a violent situation. They came with a violent mindset.
Yes.
So again, this case should be tried because the people have not done any wrong. Johannes Mezeli, Anthony Peroni, Marisol Domenici, and the other BART officers and the institution called BART itself is in the wrong. Why should we suffer an unjust judgment, and why should the family of Oscar Grant have to travel daily for a trial, miss work? Why should we, who love justice and love our brother Oscar, though we've never met him, why should we, the people of Alameda County, have to suffer so that a defense attorney can run his tricks at the court of Alameda County for the state of California? These are just tricks, smokes, and mirrors. Really, the most damaging problem they have is not us. And they should really stop that. If they listen to us, then things would be changed.
That's right.
If they listened to us, Chief G at BART would have been fired. If they were listening to us, there would be adequate police oversight organized at BART already. If they listened to us, Dorothy Duggar, the general manager of BART, would have been fired. And if they listened to us, they would have resolved their difference with the Grant family. Their problem is not us. Their problem is what the defendant has done,
that's
Johannes
right.
Mezeli. That's their problem.
That's
their problem is not public perception. Their problem is not public opinion. Their problem is the guilt of the defendant that's being represented by Attorney Raines, is that Johannes Mezeli is guilty from all vantage points that evidence have shown us, but we're not on the jury.
And what T-R-A-I-N-I, what training did the C-O cops get? What training did the cops get?
Well, look, BART cops are not real cops anyway. They're kind of like, you know, it's kind of low-key joke among law enforcement.
Is,
you know,
they, if they are, if they E-N-T enter a situation expecting, no, if they enter a situation S-C scared.
I just want to speak to that, and I understand from the activist perspective, speaking loosely, that they're not really cops. But, you know, even the activists are taxpaying citizens, and we have a right, a rightful expectation that law enforcement officers are going to be properly trained, so your question is certainly a good one. The fact of the matter is that there is no well-trained BART police officer that we have come upon as yet. And it makes it very easy for the cynical public to not view them as cops, to view them as keystone cops, to view them more as security guards, and to not give them the kind of respect that they expect to receive, but you've got to give to get. And in this case, what we don't get from them is professionally trained, highly qualified law enforcement officers who understand the rules of the game of fairness in the meeting out of justice as law enforcement officers. They don't know how to do that. Worse, they don't have a module for training. They don't have an accountability model for training. And they have a chief who sees no problem with the quality of professionalism and competence that they demonstrate at this point. In fact, the police chief promoted or sought to promote Officer Domenici within a month of the preliminary hearing after she clearly demonstrated that she did not have good control of her own personal emotions. A professionally trained law enforcement officer is accustomed to dealing with the insults of the public. If the public says, oh, you're not really a cop, you're just a security officer, we don't have to respect you, a well-trained, professionally trained law enforcement officer does not even address that. They continue to stand in a professional manner, and they carry out the policies and the procedures that have been rightfully put before them. That is not what she did, nor is it what Anthony Peroni did. During the preliminary hearing and their testimony, they consistently demonstrated their personal angst, their resentment over the fact that these young men and the public on BART were chiding them around the likelihood that they weren't well trained and were not giving them their respect. And so they became more like Joe Blow citizens who had their feelings hurt, and they behaved resentfully and behaved in a retaliatory fashion against citizens because the citizens didn't treat them with the respect that they thought they should have gotten. That is classic unprofessional. And so we have BART officers to this day who are operating under the delusion that they are well trained. We have a chief who is being permitted to promote that delusion.
That's right.
We have a general manager of BART who, in spite of an independently paid for investigation, internal investigation regarding the work of the law enforcement officers, determined that they were not competently trained. And in fact, they were operating on policies that date back to 1977. That in spite of that, the general manager still didn't see fit to fire the police chief, to fire any of the officers, or to demand that the chief hire anyone. So we have a model of unaccountability.
That's right.
And the next phase of unaccountability is that when the general manager did not do what she could have and should have done with the chief, and at the very least, Officer Peroni and Dominici, the board of directors of BART have failed to this date to exercise not only their right, but their responsibility, yes, their duty, to fire, to put on notice, fire the general director. No one in the BART organization has been accountable for the failure of that system. And so when the public cynically says they're not really cops, it is a legitimate perception when in fact they are operating under the color of law as legitimate law enforcement officers, and that's seriously problematic.
Now hold on, just factual. This is not the first time that citizens were murdered by BART police. One of the cases that I was deeply involved in was the case of Gerald Hall, a young man who was shot in the back by a BART policeman in 1992. Basically, nothing happened. Crabtree, the cop that shot Gerald in the back, didn't even get charged. He wound up committing. Well, might as well. Justice. We got a minute. It is a justice of a sort. He committed a strange form of suicide. I don't quite understand it, to tell you the truth. You can look it up. I want to move on. But it is, yeah, he committed some form of suicide. Then, and correct me on the year, if you. I think this was 2002 with Stewart, the case of Stewart. Stewart, a black man, was an auto salesman, and he was experiencing a personal crisis. He was, a mental crisis, and he got off the bus at Hayward again. This is Hayward, and people were kind of leery. They saw something was wrong. And a policeman comes up to deal with him, and this guy is taking off all his clothes. Now, this shows you how absolutely pitiful the training really was. The policeman walks up to this naked man, grabs him on the shoulders and say, "Hey, are you all right?" and shakes him. Come on. Stupid. right? Obviously, something's wrong here. You know, it's time to make a call here. Let's get the wagon over here. But because he put his hands on his brother, and I tell you, by the way, because I study these police manuals, I can tell you, they always say never approach a person in that situation. Never get close enough. Because the brother grabbed him, Stuart grabbed him, and got next thing you know, he had a stick. So now he's got this cop's stick. See? So the cop basically backed up, took his gun out, and shot and killed the man. Because he was embarrassed. Basically, felt like a fool. But killed the man. And nothing was done in this situation. Nothing. So when this happened with Oscar Grant, and we saw the immediate cover-up, we had already seen how they handled these other cases, and this cover-up was persistent. Nothing. They didn't even interview them. I mean, one of your employees just kills a citizen. Maybe the chief says, why don't you come here a minute? Why don't you have a seat? Let's turn on the tape. What happened, man? What happened? No interview? The people in the community felt there was a cover-up going on. That's what caused so much outrage. Because it's sad to say this. I hate to say this, but people have become accustomed to police murdering citizens. And people are real quick to listen to the head-fixing industry. They'll say, oh, he had a gun, or the cop thought he had a gun, or some old nonsense. No, there's a dead citizen here. This needs to be investigated. People kind of let it slide, I think. Far too much. Far too much. An indication of a lowering of social consciousness in the black community. But more importantly, once this occurs, right? Once this occurs and we see... All right, I'll see you later. Just thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
Once this occurs and you see an obvious situation where they are covering up this murder, this is what, in a large part, this is what led to the action on the 7th. This is what led to the anger. Because people saw not only did you kill him, but now you don't even respond. Nobody in authority has anything to say about this murder. It was unbelievable that no one had anything to say that was, you know, that should be accountable on this.
And A, C, C, O, according to that, there, according to their S, T, O story, the C, O, the cop, don't, K, no, the D, I difference between A taser and A gun.
Oh yeah. Well, that too.
Well, I would add that the preliminary hearing, after Judge Clay witnessed the video footage and took testimony from BART police officers and from witnesses, that one of his final statements in the conclusion remarks he gave was, he is certain, I'm paraphrasing, that Johannes Mezeli meant to pull his gun and not a taser. And one of the things that he offered was that Johannes Mezeli has yet to this day to testify or to give his side of the story to anyone in authority that's doing the investigating. And he said the only thing that he needed to know was the mindset of Johannes Mezeli when he pulled his weapon. In the 995 hearing, which was the defense's effort to throw the case out, Judge Reardon looked at video footage that we hadn't seen yet. And he started that hearing with video footage showing where Johannes Mezeli was carrying his taser. There had been great debate over when he pulled his right hand down, whether or not he pulled his taser, pardon me, pulled his gun when he meant to pull his taser. But what Judge Reardon pointed out for both attorneys, which was never in evidence from the preliminary hearing, was that Johannes Mezzali's taser was on his left hip, not his right hip. Mm-hmm. So as soon as he put that right hand down, that he was reaching for the gun. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. Every judge challenged the statements that mm-hmm. the defense attorneys were trying to offer mm-hmm. without a witness, that Mr. Mezzali thought that he was pulling his taser. Well, to be quite frank about it, he had no reason to pull any weapon mm-hmm. at all, for Oscar Grant had no weapon. So when they went into the first hearing mm-hmm. and he said, I thought, one somebody testified for him, saying that he thought that Oscar Grant had a weapon. Well, let's take the logic of that for a police officer. If I thought that this suspect has a weapon that's a threat to the life mm-hmm. of persons, I don't pull a taser, mm-hmm. I pull a gun. So the idea that some lies have been given in testimony, that they said they heard Mezzali say, I think he has a gun, or I thought he had a gun after the fact. Well, if you thought you had a gun, then he meant to pull a gun. But then they would say, I thought I was pulling my taser. Well, wait a minute, trained police officer. If you thought he had a gun, you're supposed to pull your gun. If you thought he had a gun, you don't reach for a taser. If you thought he had a gun, you pull your gun and you shoot the suspect who has a weapon that's a threat to the lives of others. And so the reality is that it is crystal clear that his partners who testified were trying to project the idea into the court testimony that Johannes Mezzali had this mysterious accident having pulled the wrong weapon. But again, the taser was on his left hip, not on his right. Mm-hmm. He would have had to cross draw with his right hand across his body to get this bright yellow taser out. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Judge Clay pointed out in his closing remarks was the way that Johannes Mezzali handled his weapon. It was not a blind shoot that you might see in a movie where a cowboy pulls his gun without looking and shoots OK Corral or the Rifleman or some expert marksman that doesn't have to handle their weapon because it's the movies. But in reality, he took his weapon carefully. The video footage shows he looked down at the gun, pulled it out the holster, gripped it with two hands, and did what police officers and any other trained gun user would do, carefully trained that weapon and fired it. His taser is bright yellow, plastic, lightweight, with a red light on it, letting you know that it's electrified or is prepared to be fired. A service revolver has none of those colors, doesn't have the same weight, doesn't have the same feel. May be a little different, or it may be shaped as a gun somewhat, has a handle, but outside of that, it's such an entirely different weapon. There's no way that a trained user of a gun could mistake his gun for a taser. On top of that, their training on the taser was only a few weeks in. They were trained at BART on tasers 3 weeks or so before Oscar Grant was killed. But again, his training on a gun was years. So with years of training with a gun, I could understand him pulling his taser and maybe it malfunctioning, or him missing the target, or being too far away as a result of a lack of training with a taser. But he's trained on the gun. There was no lack of training on the gun. So for him to not understand, quote, that he had pulled a gun would make no sense at all for a trained officer.
Okay. And he knew what, when, where, there, this, his gun was on his body. He knew where his gun was on his body. So in other words, when he reached in the direction that he reached, it wasn't like you could say, well, he just got the taser 3 weeks ago. He's kind of not sure where he's reaching. But he's had the gun there. He knows.
Right. The gun has always been there.
Yeah.
So when he made his reach for that weapon, he knew what he was reaching for.
It is a P H Y. Physical, P, part, PA, T, pattern. It's a physical pattern.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a trained pattern.
Yeah.
So in any fighting technique or athletic movement, and an athlete has been trained to react under duress, he's going to do what he's been trained to do. He was trained to use that weapon, the gun. And if he had any thought of using other than the gun, he'd have had to stop, slow down, be more considerate. Mm-hmm. But reality is, he looked at the weapon. The weapon was in its usual position. He held the weapon with two hands. And there is no way. I have a cell phone in my hand. And if I needed a gun and pointed a cell phone at you, I would know. I got the wrong thing in my hand. Well, if I can know that, and I've never used a gun, if I can know that, then surely a trained, experienced police officer would know the difference between his gun that they tell them to know their guns. When they're in military training, they might make them sleep with their guns and dismantle their guns and all those sorts of things. Pulling out his gun, he knew exactly what was in his hands.
Or if he don't and the P E R person who T R A trains him needs A L also to be on T trial. If he don't know that it's his gun that he's aiming, and then the person who trained him also needs to be on trial.
Well, I think that the Myers-Nave report and the soon-to-be-released, if it hasn't been released yet, report from the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, NOBLE, that it was very clear that the training of the BART officers was inadequate. So it is a condemnation of the administration of BART, from the board of directors to the general manager to the police chief and to everyone else involved in the preparation of these officers for duty, that everyone involved there has fallen short. And the reason that we're so angry is that even in the face of evidence and their own hired investigation having revealed this, that no one has been held accountable for the failure. Someone's, we should see employment head rolling. There should be some folk that are no longer employed. If this were a sports team, then the coach would be fired. The quarterback would be gone. The star player who didn't have the right attitude would be gone. They would start from scratch and say, I would do better to draft up some rookies that are obedient, that don't have your talent, than to keep your talent on the field and you are a detriment to the team. So Terrell, you can go. This one, you can go. I don't mean to name Terrell Owens personally. I don't know him personally. But my point here is that they will say to an athlete or a coach, you got skill, you got ability, but you're not obedient, you don't have the right attitude, you cannot play on this team. And the question becomes from BART, from the board of directors on down, and as it escalates, it'll mean from the state of California on down, will you continue to permit and allow persons that are incapable or unwilling to do right to serve the people of the state of California, the county of Alameda, and the riders on BART? As a rider on BART, and I don't ride it much, but I tell you this, when I ride it now, I will not shut one eye. I keep both my eyes open to see where BART police are. I'm not worried about the passengers. I'm concerned over whether or not its law enforcement officers would do right. My brother mentioned earlier about the confiscation of evidence from passengers. Rather than investigate the crime, BART sent officers out to find cameras, and they found one over at the Bayfair BART station that provided one of the most clear video evidences, frightened the passenger, coerced him into surrendering his video with the promise that they were going to return it to him. He never saw that video until he got to trial at the preliminary hearing. And he was frightened to come there and testify. And it's a crying shame that in 2009, that the citizens of Alameda County have to be frightened of law enforcement because we're witnesses to a crime. The reality is that that video footage is evidence in a crime, and that those who took the footage, we applaud every one of them. And as stated, the community, quite frankly, wants to trust law enforcement and government. That's a natural feeling that people have. That's why you go to the sports game and almost everybody stands up and sings the national anthem, because people want to feel that their government and the institutions that the government produces will do good by the people. BART and its way has slapped all of those people in the face by not taking responsibility and holding accountable those that were responsible for the murder of Oscar Grant. They're arguing whether or not we should even call this murder in Rain's defense.
That's right.
To change the venue. Like, we shouldn't call it murder after we watched a young man murdered on live video. I call it what I want. I'm a free man. And Mr. Rains can't tell me what language I can and I cannot use in speaking to a videotape that I saw with my own two eyes. When I was a child, I saw the movie Friday the 13th. And when I left that movie, Jason was a killer. So if I can say that coming out of Friday the 13th, then you'd better believe that what I saw on January the 1st of 2009 was far worse than anything you could see fabricated in a fictional movie.
Yeah.
This is reality. And I would rather wake up worrying about Jason than have to ride BART worrying about Johannes Mezzali and Anthony Perron.
Right. And other sociopaths like them. You know,
I'd like to actually add one thing.
Please.
Me, is that I think that in the light of what you're saying, Minister Keith, that it's an affront to the community in particular to suggest that the community's responsibility and engagement with this issue and with this offense, right, to young men in the community, young black men in particular, is almost a dissent of law. I think that really is an affront, that Michael Rains is making that case, that the engagement of the community, the peaceful engagement of the community for that matter, the responsible and professional engagement,
that's
is
right,
actually a disrespect of the rule of law. In many ways, that's very insulting, you know, to have professional, educated, responsible, totally committed, and passionate people say, no, the rule of law must not break the law itself, right? Police officers must not break the law. We are trusting them to protect us. We're trusting them to protect our children. And I think that we need to also pay attention to that language, right? That sort of manipulation of language.
And you know, not one of the meetings or the protests that were held included irresponsible pronouncements from the microphone. Mayor Dellums spoke on the January 14th rally held in front of City Hall. I and many others spoke that day. I spoke, like my brother said, at the Fruitvale BART station on January the 7th. No one spoke irresponsibly. We have performed our civic duty. I participated with BART Board of Directors and police union representatives to help them to craft an oversight model. We've done the responsible thing. BART went to Sacramento and hijacked the model and offered it to an assemblyman in a hijacked form. We have not been irresponsible. BART has been irresponsible. We've given them the benefit of our thinking to secure justice in the murder of Oscar Grant. And the fact that we meet about it every week only means we really want justice. We really don't want this swept under the rug. And we really will not tolerate that Attorney Rains would insult our intelligence. And if you read his change of venue motion, it's a perfect insult to a people that have only done good by the community. Those that they quoted have not lifted a finger against anybody. Those that they quoted have not committed any acts of violence. Those that they quoted have not threatened the public safety. We've only said to those in government, do your job that we elected you to perform, and we pay you to perform. So as I see it, every BART officer works for me as they work for you, because we're tax-paying citizens, and we should not tolerate from our employees the kind of behavior that was seen on January the 1st, and that any employee that thinks that it was right should be fired with those that should have been fired on January the 1st. I personally would poll the entire police department. I personally think that they should offer psychological assessments to every officer on the department to determine their states of mind after the murder of Oscar Grant. Because if you've got officers that feel like what happened to him he deserved because he asked some questions, like, why are you detaining me? And somehow that means that he's qualified to be shot, as Dr. Tosco said earlier. You're talking about officers that apparently have an extreme inferiority complex.
That's it.
When someone says to them, you're not a real cop, you're BART cop, does that mean to kill someone?
That's it. Is that the death penalty?
Or even to taser. It wouldn't even justify no weapons necessary
on that night.
Yeah.
I'm wondering though, now, but you know, okay, we do have different ways of looking at this stuff, because I understand that police are employees, but I tell you, man, the frequency, you know, how frequently they murder
black people,
unarmed black citizens, this is not an accident.
That's right.
I got to look at this, and I got to start putting it together. And what I see is that there's a machinery. This state is a machinery. And the core of it is these prisons, the courts, and these cops. And I see, I don't know, I think when you, I remember one time I went to San Francisco to the Hall of Justice. I said, Jesus, this is 1984. What? I see that this is, that what you have is two things happening at once. You have a stated position that they represent us, and an actual thing, they murder, wantonly murder unarmed citizens. And when that occurs, they are not disciplined for it. That's not an accident.
This was the first time in California state history that any peace officer has been charged with a capital offense against a citizen in the state of California. Now, there have been other events that are well known in the state of California where innocent people have been gunned down. Right here in Oakland, the first Black Panther to lose his life, a teenager, little Bobby Hutton, unarmed, shot multiple times by OPD. So we're well aware that our people are victims of regular and consistent police shootings. Right. A simple Google search would give you the percentage of police shooting victims that are Black. Here we're 13% of the county of Alameda. At what percentage of police-involved shootings have as victims Black men? I would imagine you're probably talking somewhere like 85 to 90%. I don't know the exact number, but I'm sure you're going to be in that 85, 90-something percent number. Here we're 13% of the county and 80, 90% of the victims of police shootings.
Why?
So my brother knows why.
That's
the history of America.
Well, that's what we're getting at, and we're not just talking about history. We're making history. Because while it is true, it's also true that at this moment in history, there's extreme duress and disorientation in this nation. I'm telling you, it's not a minor thing. When you have citizens, I used to think CNN was supposed to be like, you know, the best news programming, you know, that they had to offer, that the capitalists have to offer, right? Well, that CNN now has lowered itself to the point where they're an organizing center for these birthers.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff. What is a birther? A birther is a citizen that wants to see Obama's birth certificate and believes that Obama, President Obama, is not an American citizen. It may seem simple-minded. We laugh at work and joke about it a lot. But we have to be serious about this. There are people in this country that actually believe that. I'm sorry.
Not only that, but from the time of his inauguration to now, while he was campaigning, he was the most threatened U.S. presidential candidate in history.
30 a day.
I'm a member of the Nation of Islam.
30 a day.
My leader, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, defended physically the life of the Reverend Jesse Jackson when he ran for president in 1984, and brothers like myself surrounded Reverend Jackson before the CIA, not the CIA, but the Secret Service stepped in, because there had been over 100 people arrested with very real death threats against his life.
Mm.
Now, Reverend Jackson, of course, backs out of the campaigns later, and President Obama would run his campaign. He received more death threats than Reverend Jackson did because it was clear that he was had a greater potential as a candidate to win.
Mm-hmm.
When it became apparent that he might win, the death threats against President Obama were so great, they hadn't seen anything like that before. And then you take it a step further, when he won, the anger caused more guns to be purchased in certain parts of the country than in history. So you've got people in militias arming themselves. This is real talk. Now that he's president, from the time of his inauguration until now, according to a CNN newscast the other night, that death threats against him have increased 400%.
Oh, really?
And the Secret Service has never seen any president under this kind of threat in history. Now, that's saying a lot since several presidents have been killed. So we're concerned for our brother's safety, but we expect that in some political minds and in some militant militia white supremacist minds, some of whom are in law enforcement, that we should expect and calculate for a certain kind of backlash against the people. That's why it's important that BART should actually psychoanalyze all of its officers. Where did an officer like Anthony Peroni come from? Or Johannes Mezeli come from, then an unarmed man can be hurled to his face and called the B word, the A word, and the N word in rapid succession, and 30 seconds later he's dead. Where did that mind come from? And I heard Peroni say in testimony, well, he called me a name. Maybe I was just responding to what he called me. Well, that's fine. He's talking for free. You're paid to accept the insults of people and perform your duty as a police officer. So they can call you pig, they can say oink oink to you, they can call you whatever comes to their heart and mind that they feel like because of the freedom of speech. If their words are not offering a material threat, then those words can be overlooked by a law enforcement officer that is well trained. That's why we're saying that BART officers really should be removed from duty until the training is secure and a psychoanalysis is done on every single officer. Because if I or my loved ones see Anthony Peroni at a BART station, I would tell them, get off the train and get out of the station. Because obviously, he's a man with a mental disorder. Johannes Mezeli should be convicted, but Anthony Peroni should be tried and convicted for his own involvement as an accessory to the murder of Oscar Grant.
Yeah, because he set the tone of what happened on that platform. It's very important. You know, that's what people don't get. And, you know, they show a film of someone being shot in the back on the ground. Just by the way, this question about if they thought he had a gun, this nonsense. Before you throw the man on the ground, don't you think you want to check and see if you frisk him? I'm talking about basic competency. Basic stuff, you know? I mean, this is out to lunch. these guys were.
I mean, and the other thing was that the claim in court by the officers was that Meserle said he couldn't see his hands or he couldn't get at Oscar Grant's hands, and the videotape in court definitely demonstrated that Oscar's hands were behind his back. Mm. They were clearly visible. And that should say something about just the perjury on the stand that was going on. But just also, I mean, I think it's also documented evidence that there were two other black men who were killed in the United States that night in New Orleans and in Texas. And so I think the sort of pathology that we're talking about of white supremacy that is existing in our country is something we need to really address. And this case really brings it up. It exposes it. I mean, when you have a historical legacy of white supremacy in this country where there has been violence against black people, via the state, via police officers historically, that's been happening, through the law. I mean, we have to be very honest about this, and I think it further calls for an engagement from citizens, from law-abiding, tax-paying citizens, to expose this, right? And to really address this pathology and to say, even to iterate the words, the B word, the A word, the N word, three times in a row as a police officer is to also re-inscribe that white supremacist logic, to affirm it, right? And so we have to really address the training of officers, the professionalism, and we have to address this issue of violence against black people. It's not random. Black people are criminalized, right? They are criminalized and they're pathologized via the system. And I think we really have to address whether that criminalization is coming from a pathological system itself. And there's an accountability system that has to go into place, and that has to go in through training and through holding people legally accountable for allowing officers with guns out in public.
And I have to add, as our people really want to trust government, and I was with Mayor Dellums at a certain point the night he went out on January the 7th when protesters were on the street. And Mayor Dellums was personally hurt by the fact that the protesters, whom he worked to protect, as a mayor with an activist background, he personally called off law enforcement from engaging the crowds, particularly as they were nearing City Hall. But when he spoke to the crowd, they were angry with him, even though he had nothing to do, particularly with the murder of Oscar Grant. But I told him, he came in with tears in his eyes, wondering why they were cursing him. And I said, well, Mr. Mayor, it's because to them, you are the current face of government. Mm-hmm. And most of these young people and older people that are on the street don't know the mayor. They don't know the city council people. They don't know the county supervisors. They know the police. So the introduction of government to poor black people is not in elected office. It's the face of government that's militarized on the street and has mistreated us with regularity. So to the minds of the poor, I'm oppressed by the government. Not because the mayor or the council or the supervisors have handled me in any way, shape, or form. I don't even know who they are. But who I do know is these rioters in West Oakland. I know Dirty Rob out there abusing people out in West Oakland. I know Meserle now, and I know Anthony Peroni now, but I don't have very little knowledge of Mayor Dellums. So when he went out to speak to the people, they were very forthright in their words against him as the face of government, in some cases not even realize that he ordered the police to back up off of the crowd. They didn't realize that. He was attempting to hear them and attempting to keep the situation peaceful, but there was so much passion on that night that some of the officers began to press their way in, and it became unproductive the mayor to stay out of the street.
Wait a minute now, but remember what came out of his mouth when he addressed the crowd, because I will never forget that. The first thing come out of his mouth is talking about some talk about don't be tearing stuff up. And personally, just from a point of view of being effective, that wasn't very intelligent. Because man's in the ground here. Because of a grave injustice has occurred. I don't know. I'm not a speechwriter, but I can tell you, I've definitely One, he could have said, look, I am not directly on top of or in charge of the BART police, so I can't promise you that I'm going to immediately resolve this through the normal channels. But clearly, an injustice is taking place. That's the first thing you said. That was not the first thing my man said. I'm sorry, Keith. Nobody want to be, you know,
no need to
kicking around. But man, you know, people were angry. I was there, and I was shocked that that wasn't the first thing that came out of his mouth. But he's talking about that property question, you know, and don't tell him, you know, come on, y'all, calm down. Wrong thing. If people are looking for justice, address that on some level. Don't be afraid. If you call yourself a leader, address the problem first. That's the main problem. That's right. Because most people did not come down there to tear stuff up. They came to protest an injustice.
That's right.
And actually, I think in his heart of hearts, he believes an injustice took place. He was disoriented, I guess. I don't know. But that was
more than likely. I mean, I don't think there's a rule book for an elected official to step out in the way that he stepped out. I don't know that it's ever happened before that an elected official has stepped into that kind of reality. So we respected him. And out of respect for his effort, we did not want to see him hurt.
No. But I was shocked, though. I was shocked because I thought he was a little sharper than that. You know.
Show. I have to end the show. At to be able to do get it on television because of the time.
Okay, what can we just address one thing before results and kind of prospects thing? We've talked about the history. But now, I think it's appropriate to have a prognosis. Because we're here. Let's go through this one time. What do we think is most likely to occur? Because I happen to think that Mr. Raines is totally desperate. And I think it's in vain. I do not think he's going to get the change of venue. And I actually believe that Mr. I call him Miserly. I don't like to even pronounce his name right. But Mr. Mesley's going to go to prison. That's what I kind of think. But is that inevitable? Are there possible twists and obstacles along this road? If he were to get a change of venue, would it be possible for any jury to let this Mesley go? Or no, maybe not. Remember, you don't need but one person on the jury to lock it up.
To let it go.
That's right. So, real quick, if they get the change of venue, is it possible in today's America for 12 American citizens to let Mesley go?
Yes. I would say the answer is yes. Because it only takes one of the 12 to let him go.
Possible. It is possible. Yes.
So we want to be very watchful and vigilant to ensure that justice is served. Now,
probable.
I have to say, as a and man probable. Of faith, my brother said that he believes that they will do the right thing. I don't know if I believe that they will do the right thing, but I believe that God will do the right thing. And whether or not a court of law finds Mesley guilty or not, there's no way that he can escape justice, because ultimately justice will be in the hand of God. And that we should know that God's hand is not independent of the hands of human beings who are empowered to change the way a system functions. So when we place our faith in God, in my view, we don't wait for a mystery to bring about the change, but we do all that we can with what strength we are given to produce the justice that America and the people of righteousness really deserve.
I work with birthers, so I just, you know, I don't live in a narrow, small world where with only co-thinkers and we slap each other five and everything, we agree on everything. I work with people who actually are not very well, as far as I'm concerned, psychologically or socially. This sickness, though, is widespread, and we're seeing it's busting out all over this country. I'm not sure. I have to say, I'm a little befuddled by the degree of stupidity, the degree of ignorance in my fellow Americans. I would like to see something effectively done, and I'm afraid that our government officials can't handle it. Just a quick side story. Me and 25 other trade unionists went up to Concord to ensure that a meeting would be able to take place peacefully. When they started going around shouting people down, we weren't going to allow that to happen, because we think that Americans have a right and a need to discuss, you know, important issues like healthcare. And when we found out they were paying people to do that, we felt it was time to take action. And this is the sad truth. The congressman who organized the meeting, Mr. Miller, was so intimidated by these mob, you know, this type of thing, that he canceled the meeting. He canceled the meeting. He couldn't face the nation. That is what's going on here. So we don't know what's going to happen. We really don't. And I tell you, I see, I'm not, and nobody, you know, it's easy to say, oh, if they let them go, then people are tired. That's not useful, you know? Because what I want, personally, is not a evening of anger and a couple of broken windows. But I would like to see people decide that they are ready to change the way they live and commit themselves to consistently following a path that will lead to a correction of this nation. See? It's not easy. It's very difficult. But that's what's needed. This problem is not going to be solved in one night with one rock or one bottle.
On that note, we should say goodnight.
Okay.
Thank you very much, folks.
Okay. Good night.
Good morning, folks.